Hi, you're listening to the My Body, My Story podcast.
Our bodies are essential for a reason. We have those erogenous zones for a reason. Learning that and removing that guilt was a huge weight off my shoulders, and I empowered myself. I was in control. It was all my doing, and I was empowered by it. And then this injury happened, and it got taken all away again without my consent. And that's where my insecurities come from.
This is the 45 over 45 chapter where we celebrate rule breakers and role models, the women who inspire us to live life our way and to show their sensuality, beauty, soul, and true essence. Here, we talk about what it's like to be 45 plus, adjusting to the changes that come with time, and we listen to the stories of our participants. If you have an interesting story, we'd love for you to participate. You can email us at info@alexandrawalker.com. That's Alexandra spelt with a K-S. Or visit our website, alexandrawalker.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the My Body, My Story project. And today with us in the studio, Danica. And while she's sitting in the makeup chair and Lior is creating her magic, we're going to talk and I'm going to ask you a few questions. Let's start and tell us 10 facts about yourself.
10 facts about me. I'm one of seven children. I'm the second eldest of seven kids. We were poor family, but you wouldn't have known it from the outside because my parents were the hardest working people I've ever met in my life. My mum, even though she was a stay-at-home mum, she had four jobs on top of it, along with all of us kids. My dad was travelling sales, so he got the best of that parenting role because he was away for the week and then he'd come back for the weekend. Usually Friday nights when we're all bathed, had dinner, getting ready for the bedtime routine, and dad just got to come in and go, hey. So that was growing up.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in Yarrawonga in Victoria. Mm-hmm. And then we travelled when I was about 4 years old. The first four, because we had four down in Victoria and three up in Lismore. Mm-hmm. And we travelled up and down the east coast of Australia trying to find somewhere. Mum and Dad just packed everything up, sold everything and got in the car and drove. And Alstonville was the place that Mum and Dad really loved on the way through, and they made it all the way up to North Queensland. Mm-hmm. And then we found our way back down to Alstonville where they bought, and that's where I grew up. Just about 30 minutes southwest of Byron Bay. Mm-hmm. So that's where I grew up. And went to Alstonville Primary, Alstonville High School.
And now where are you located?
I'm now in Gnellabar, which is just up the top of Lismore. And that, how I ended up there, that's a whole nother story. I'm a single mum, have been for nearly 13 years, which is where I ended up back at home again because my ex-partner and I, we moved to London for a couple of years. Mm. And we travelled around Europe and then we first started trying for kids, but because I'd been on the pill for as long as I was over 10 years on one of the highest doses, mm-hmm. when we spoke to the doctor about, you know, planning to have children, he goes, look, it's probably going to be like 18 months, 2 years, because your body has been on this contraception for so long for it to be actually probably fertile. Mm-hmm. And we were like, yeah, that's cool, because that means we can go and live in Sweden, we can go and do this, we can, you know, and when it happens, it'll happen. Mm-hmm. And a month later, I was pregnant, so that kind of threw our plans.
That was quick.
Which I should have known, because like six out of the seven kids were all contraception babies. So ooh. My older sister was the only one that wasn't, you know, that was not contraception, conceived on the wedding night. The rest of us are all contraception babies. Like one of my brothers, mum had the copper implant, and she was nearly 5 months pregnant before she realised she was pregnant.
Oh, God.
So then they had to get the implant out without aborting the baby, because that would have aborted the baby eventually when he got even bigger. So that's how much we're contraception babies. They're just very fertile.
Strong genes.
Very fertile. That's why I was just like, oh man, I should have known. Should have known. But then when we moved, because I got severe hyperemesis, which is basically, it's hyperemesis gravidarum, which, you know, so many women go through when they're pregnant, but it's not really spoken about. They just call it, a lot of doctors call it just morning sickness, mm-hmm. when it's not. It's an actual severe medical condition. You know, in London, they had a whole ward for, it's the hyperemesis ward for women. You could go in and you can get hooked up for an IV for a couple of hours just to replenish your fluids because you're vomiting 24/7. It's horrendous. My blood pressure was about 86 over 43. So I was like walking dead. I passed out minimum 5 times a day.
And how many kids do you have?
2 boys.
And all the same story every time?
Both of them. Yeah. Both of them were horrendous. I have to keep changing my language though when I'm telling that story if my kids are around, because I don't want them to think that they were horrendous or there was anything wrong with them, because they were perfect. They were huge. That's the whole point. That's what hyperemesis is. They've linked it to the pregnancy hormone. So the higher the pregnancy hormone, the sicker you are. So at 6 weeks pregnant, I could have looked after 3 other pregnancies with the amount of hormone that I was carrying or producing, I should say. So like super fertile. So the babies were massive. They were huge. They were healthy, big fat babies, 9 pound 4 and nearly 9 pound for the second one. I think it was all in their heads though. They had massive heads, 95th percentile. That's 2 facts.
well, I think it's more, but it's...
I don't know. I'm a mental health worker. We just secured a lease for an office because we're about to start building a business proposal for a mental health crisis centre, so like a mental health emergency department that's separate from the hospital and separate from community mental health. Yeah. So there's an in-between point, because at the moment there's mental health in community and then it's the extreme locking them up in the psych ward. Mm-hmm. There's no intervention in between. If someone's in a crisis, that crisis could be de-escalated quite quickly just by having contact with a person and someone talking to them, maybe some PRN, and maybe, you know, even just 2 nights, really good sleep and good feed, that type of stuff, and connection with people. They don't need to be locked up and handed heavy antipsychotics and zombified for 2 weeks straight and then dumped back out on the streets again. But you're okay again, you know. So we're trying to build a bridge between the extreme psych ward and in community mental health. So people can come in if they're feeling escalated or they've got a drug-induced psychosis or they haven't been able to sleep, they've got a little bit manic and that type of thing. They can come in and actually get some help immediately, because at the moment when someone's in a crisis, the only plan is to call an ambulance and police and then put them in the emergency department. And then they, because they're not...
And wait for 3 hours or 4.
Well, 13 hours. You know, there's a 13... Usually, like, I've had sat with one client because I knew if I didn't sit with them, they would have left. And they needed to be seen. They needed to get some help. And we sat there for 13 hours and in a room by themselves. And so that's why I was in there. And... I think probably 3 times in that 13 hours somebody came in just to check in and then went back out again. And then they wonder why these people who are in crisis end up having police and security called on them and they're being tasered in the ED and all that type of stuff. Yeah. It's like, well, you treat somebody like they don't exist and that they're invisible. Mm. They're going to respond in a reactive way to make you pay attention to them.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not hard to, you know, just go and sit with somebody, give them a cup of coffee, have a chat, find out what the hell's going on, you know. a lot of my clients, in the Northern Rivers where we're from, we've got some of the highest mental health incidences in Australia and some of the lowest mental health services.
So why do you think it's to do with this area? Is this kind of remote area?
Well, I think because, Byron Bay is only just down the road, so it's quite a popular destination. We've also got Nimbin is just up the road, which is the drug capital of Australia. Anything you want, head to Nimbin. So I think there's a lot of drugs there as well, but also just the fact that it's a very laid-back, accepting community. So to be unwell is you're kind of safer to be unwell there than you would be if you were to be as unwell as what some of these people are in a city. They'd be locked up. They'd be, you know, you'd end up getting put in secure facilities and that type of thing. So of some of them, they need the secure facility, but, you know, there's just such a massive gap. So one of my other friends and I are building a business plan and we've just secured the office. So we're going to start off with just within the NDIS stuff, getting training mental health specific workers, because there's a lot of disability workers, You can drown in disability workers, but when it comes to actual mental health specific workers, there's not many. And there's not many that actually have the knowledge and insight or lived experience into mental health that can have a bigger understanding, which creates a bigger umbrella for these people to be able to feel connected and, you know, taken care of. So that's what we're kind of working on, trying to build that community of workers with the knowledge and the care and the empathy and the lived experience, but healed lived experience, to be able to help guide others through their journey of recovery. The level of mental health that I work in is usually complex. So there's not, using the term recovery doesn't really come into the, because there is no recovery from these illnesses. It's basically trying to help them be the best version of themselves in the space that they're in. So like some of my clients have live in permanent psychosis, like 24/7 delusional. So, you know, I've got one guy who was a mermaid and then, you know, aliens abducted him and they split his tail and one, my right butt cheek's bigger than my left. See, Danica, look, look. And you just go into the world with them. You don't, and this is what I try to teach people and new workers that come along. You have to remember that this entire field is not about you. And these people are living with horrendous mental illnesses, a lot of them schizophrenia, which means they have auditory hallucinations pretty much 24/7 a day. Some of them have the visual hallucinations in conjunction with it, or just visual hallucinations, but majority of them have the auditory, so they're hearing things constantly, 24/7 a day. Just imagine how exhausting that is. And yet they still manage to get up and try to live their lives, try to do something. And instead of them looking for ways to self-medicate, we're trying to give them an option to actually be in that mode, but have someone to support them through it. So like if they've got a new voice that's come along and they're really terrified by it, and we kind of help them to fight back, you know, recognizing that what's happening to them is very real for them. So say to somebody come in and go, oh, it's not real. You go, well, you have no idea, because for them it's very 100% real.
So but how did you come to this field? Like, I know you mentioned that you were in a different field before. So what did you do before you...
I was in the army as a combat medic.
So it's a good base for the...
Yeah,
care what you field. Do now.
Care field. Yeah. I get it from my mum because we were also a foster family. So on top of us, 7 kids from my parents, we took in 48 kids over 12 years on top of that.
Wow.
So my mum's kind of like a mother hen and she kind of just, everyone comes, all of our friends, my mum's your mum now, you know, that type of thing. And that's kind of where all of us kids have gone into some sort of care field or building field, you know, to try and create something, community connection, all that type of stuff. So when I got out of the army, there's a massive crisis in veteran mental health, massive. And like during 2020, in the first 3 months of 2020, we lost triple the amount of veterans than what we did in the entire Afghan war. So in the 20 years we were at war, just in the first 3 months of 2020, we lost triple that amount in 3 months to suicide from PTSD. So it's only just starting to get recognised as a disability, and there's still, though, the treatment for it is medication. And so then they're just still left on their own. There's still no connection. There's still no bridge there for them. Like when you join the army, you've got 12 weeks at Kapuka, and then you go and do your trade, you know, study your trade and wherever you are, and then you go and do your 4 years contract. That's a long time to dehumanize you and turn you into a soldier. But then when you get out, it's 1 week reintegration training. 1 week to learn how to be in normal civilization, human being again. And so they get out, and some of them have been lifers, you know, they've been in there for 38, 40 years. And then all of a sudden they've got to be in the civilian world. And it's like, you get 1 week training for that. And then they're left on their own. It's not as bad as what it used to be, you know, but there's still so much to do. So that's where I moved into suicide prevention, crisis intervention. Mm-hmm. And I worked in that field as a volunteer from the beginning, just while my kids were little. So I was doing something still in that.
How old are you now?
My boys are 15 and 13 now. Mm. Yeah, teenagers.
Teenagers. Nice age.
Well, it was touch and go there for a little while. I was like, oh, my God, I'm failing. This is so hard, you know, because their dad isn't around. He probably sees them maximum 4 times a year. Mm. So it's been just me raising these two. And I'm like, oh, you know, mums always feel like they're failing anyway. That's just how it is. But then being a single mum on top of it, and then you see, like, when they were little, I was poor as. Like, you really, really scratch things together. And so you feel like you're not providing for them. You feel like they're missing out on everything. And but then I look back on it now and I go, they didn't really. Like, when my youngest was 3, my eldest was 5, because I'm ADHD, here's another fact. I'm also ADHD. I'm very impulsive, and so I had some money come in, and it was still winter, and one of my Italian mates was a snowboarding instructor in Mount Buller. So I booked a trip to Mount Buller for the snow for the week, just out of nowhere. Had no snow gear. We're from Lismore. We don't get snow. It doesn't even really get that cold. And so I'm like, we've gone down to Mount Buller to buy train and bus because it was free for single parents on the pension for in the state travel. So I was like, sure, let's do that. Impulsive, why not?
So how was that?
Oh, it was amazing. So I look back at that now and I go, I've given my kids some pretty amazing experiences.
Exactly.
You know, like,
so that was the right impulsive decision.
Yeah, it was that one was. But they and then my big boy, when he was in year 7, he's in year 10 now. I told this story last night. One of the little girls in his year, she got her period and it had leaked through. Mm-hmm. And he took his jumper off and wrapped it around her waist. Aww. And took it to the sick bay and spoke to the lady for her and said, you know, can you get her some pants and probably call her mum? I've just brought her here so she doesn't get picked on. And I was just, when I heard that, because the teachers rang me and told me, and I heard that and I was just like, okay, I'm not doing too bad.
Yeah.
You know, like I've got a young man there who's, yes, he's had a single mum, but I think that's actually helped because he's autistic as well and ADHD. And so for him to actually see that and recognise that as that he needed to, he didn't need to, he didn't have to, but he wanted to step in to help her and protect her. And because he, you know, because my boys have grown up with me who I lack a filter. My intrusive thoughts tend to not be just in here, they come out my mouth. So, and then it's, I'm as surprised as everybody else is what I'm saying. I'm like, oh, I said that, sorry. Don't know where that came from. So for him to actually be able to step up and have that empathy and that, you know, care nature about him, I was like, okay.
I'm doing well.
I'm not doing well, but I just say I'm not doing too bad. I haven't failed on this one. The same in the mental health side of things, you know, because I work so much. Like I do like 11 and a half hour days, 12 out of 14 days a fortnight. Running my own business now, I don't work for an organisation or anything, so it's all on me.
So is it your own business or it's your own business?
Yeah.
So if someone wants to find you, how they can find you? Do you have a website?
My name. Yeah, I haven't got a website yet, but we're going to be, so like I'm partnering up with one of my other friends who's a psych nurse. Mm-hmm. And we've got a team of workers already that work independently, but as a team for us. And then we're going to be, the name of the crisis centre is what we're going to name the little mini NDIS organisation, mm-hmm. so that when we get the business plan for the crisis centre through, up and going, then that name can, and people already know about it, and it can just transfer to the actual crisis centre then.
If they want to find you and need your help.
It's just my name.
And they will have contact like on the internet?
Yeah, well, I mean, all of my clients, all support coordinators, caseworkers, they've all got my number. Mm. So we get, same with my friend Sophie, who's the psych nurse. She's also a support coordinator now and a psychosocial recovery coach. Mm-hmm. And she, everyone's ringing us every day going, do you have capacity for this? Or can you put a team together for this client and that type of stuff? Which is really exciting because now it means that we can actually put people in place that have knowledge in regards to mental health care.
Yeah.
Because it's, once again, it's completely different to disability care. Mm-hmm. You could be the most amazing disability worker in the world, but if you come across into the psychosocial side of things without any prior knowledge into severe complex mental illness, then you're going to drown. Because like I was saying before, we try to teach people to remember that this entire shift that you're doing with this person has nothing to do with you.
Yeah.
You need to leave your ego. You need to leave any expectations that you have completely at the door because you have no idea what you're walking into every single day. Whether they're having a good day or whether they're having a bad day or whether the voices are really loud or whether the, you know, whatever's happening. Because some of them have dual diagnoses, so they've got comorbidities and then there's addiction, so self-medication, all that type of stuff on top of it. So you can't come in with any expectations. And if you had a win the day before, you can't come in expecting them to do that win ever again, you know. It's just enjoy the win for what it is in that moment.
One day at a time.
Well, one moment at a time with mental health because it can change so quickly. Yeah. You can be one minute, you'll be, you know, laughing your ass off with them and having a great old time and the next minute they're screaming at the sky, you know, and getting quite violent, verbally violent and that type of stuff. So it's, you've got to take each moment as it comes.
It's a hard work.
It is hard, but I love it. Like I absolutely love it. And so I'm one of my favourite people, one of my all-time favourite clients. And I've told her, I said, even when I'm not your carer anymore, your worker anymore. I said, you and I are growing old together, woman. We're going to be sitting on the front porch rocking in our chairs with our shotgun screaming at people to get off our grass. And I'm actually now also, that's the other thing is, that's why this project was something that's jumped out to me because I do a lot of work in regards to women's mental health and getting recognition within the medical industry in changing diagnostic tools that they use. Because there's a lot of women that have been diagnosed
with some pretty heavy mental illnesses and living in completely awful situations, medication wise. They're on antipsychotics when actually it's a hormonal imbalance. Mm. 6 out of 8 women have PMDD, which is premenstrual dysphoria disorder. 6 out of 8 women, and they go undiagnosed because they get labelled borderline personality, bipolar, severe depression, severe anxiety, you know, just, it's just your monthlies, you know, all that type of stuff. Mm. When actually it's a severe hormonal imbalance that is causing psychosis, which they don't recognise because the majority of diagnostic tools out there are based on men. So, yeah, it was, I'm working really hard to actually get women's mental health recognised and getting diagnostic tools to be changed in particular to recognise the differences for women to men. I had one lady who was just permanent psychosis. She'd been, you know, wiped off. She'd, you know, they said this is her for life. She's lost her family. She lost a job. She lost everything. And they had her on every antipsychotic under the sun you could possibly think of. She'd put on massive amounts of weight and she was crying to this doctor saying, this is not working. Like, I'm not okay. This is not changing. Nothing's changing. All I just feel is even worse because now I'm fat and nothing's changing at the top. Mm-hmm. And he wouldn't listen to her. He was just going to add another antipsychotic to it until I actually screamed at him. Not very professional. I tend to run by my emotions a bit much when it comes to that type of thing because of my passion towards it. And I stood up in that room and I said, you need to shut the up and start listening to what she's saying to you. She is telling you that this isn't working. So you need to go back to ground zero and you need to start again and you need to start doing, you know, all the blood tests, get everything sorted out and get to the bottom of what the hell's happening here. He wouldn't listen. Mm-hmm. And then, so I screamed at him to do that and then he got all offended. And then I found a female doctor in Ballina who's one of the most amazing female doctors I've ever dealt with. And she did all of these blood tests and scans and found out that this woman had a severe hyperthyroid, like off the charts hyperthyroid. And so she started treating the thyroid condition. And my client is no longer a client. She's completely stabilised and there's no mental health repercussions, nothing anymore, because now her hormones and everything that was going on chemically wise has stabilised. So the hormones have all gone back to normal and she's got zero mental illness.
Yeah. Hormones is always the main issue, I think, with the woman's health, especially when we're aging. And so I want to move to the questions about aging and body image issues. Yep. And as we started talking about hormones, definitely with age, we have shift, not in the, like it's a shift of hormones changing in our bodies and, you know, like all sorts of changes. But what does aging means to you? Like, how old are you now? And at this age, what do you think about aging?
Well, it's funny because when I was younger, if I looked at a 43-year-old woman when I was 18, back when I was 18, that looked so old. And I was like, oh my God, imagine being that old. And now I am 43 and I don't feel like I look like I thought 43 would look like.
Yeah.
Or feel like.
Not that old.
No, like it's really not old at all. Like I still feel like I'm mentally, I still feel like I'm, you know, in my 20s type thing. Mm. Physically, that's a totally different issue because my body's so broken. But mentally, I still feel, I don't feel like what I thought 43 would feel like. Mm. So, you know, if anything, I wish menopause would hurry up and take over. So there's certain things I don't want to have to deal with anymore, which is, you know, it's exciting to me, is not having to ever deal with, you know, your menstrual cycle.
Be careful what you wish for. Yeah. I'll tell you, that's not the best part of the either. Well,
I mean, because I'm also PMDD, which is what I was talking about before. I'm on CBD oil for it to try and help, because CBD is really good for hormone stabilization as well, and it's a natural product. And so my doctor has got me on that, which has been amazing. And, you know, some of the treatments for PMDD are like hysterectomy, because that's how extreme the hormonal imbalance is. So having a hysterectomy and being put through menopause that way is actually more stabilizing for a woman. So obviously it's different for each.
But what, at the moment, what do you think is aging? Like what that means to you?
For me, it's just more being able to just not give a crap what other people think anymore. You know, when I look at myself in the mirror, I don't think about what somebody else is going to think seeing this or doing, like wearing that. Whereas, you know, when I was younger, it was always about what you chose to wear and how you chose to look was about what other people are going to perceive you as. Mm-hmm. Whereas now it's, I don't care. Like it's a real freedom. I feel aging is quite freeing, being able to just be whoever the hell you want to be and do whatever the hell you want to do. And if anybody thinks they have the right to have an opinion or anything about what it is that you're doing, you just don't care. You just go, sorry,
yeah,
that's a you problem. It's got nothing to do with me. So that's kind of where I'm at. That's what aging is for me. Obviously, my insecurities, they're not coming from aging. The reason why I'm doing this project isn't coming from because I'm getting old. It's because of the physical issues that I have, you know, not working within the body anymore and learning how to embrace myself again, because it's taken a long time to be empowered by just being me and then to have what happen and have that taken away again. It's regaining that power and control of myself again and confidence in my body and being grateful to my body for what it has been through to still be here.
So you mentioned that you had injury that limited your mobility, and that's what you're talking about, right?
Yes, so I got injured at work. The organisation I did work for, they were terrible with paperwork and terrible with everything in general. And they put me on with a brand new client and who turns out that she was just straight disability. She was in a wheelchair. And I turn up and the mother leaves and I'm left with this woman who's not mental health at all, and she's in full sound of mind. I had to lift her in and out of the wheelchair all day for the entire day, in and out, shower, toilet, all that type of stuff. With no lifter, the house wasn't set up for wheelchair access, so that was all pokey and you were in awkward positions when trying to lift her out and stuff. So you weren't able to do proper lifting techniques and anything like that. So I ended up rupturing two discs in my back, which put me in hospital. 11:30 that night, I called the paramedics and they came out, but they couldn't give me anything, being a single mum, and it was so late, because if they gave me any pain relief, I'd have to go to hospital and they couldn't take the kids with them because there was nobody looked after them. And because the medication that they were going to use was going to be quite a heavy-duty pain relief, which means I wasn't going to be responsible for my children. So I was like, okay, I'll wait until morning and I just get through the night, then I can get the kids to school and then I'll take myself to hospital. And the next morning I made it through the night just, and I went to go and have a shower I took three steps. It took nearly 45 minutes to get undressed, out of bed, undressed, to go to the shower. And I took three steps towards the shower and I went into full body spasm. My lungs seized up, pushed all the air out, everything locked up, so it dropped me to the floor. So then the paramedics ended up having to come anyway. Ended up in hospital for a week and a half, and they were going to be sending me to Gold Coast to get surgery on my spine because they said they're done, the discs are done, and there's no repairing those. But then WorkCover stepped in, and it was another 18 months before I was able to get the surgery approved. So I had 18 months worth of damage, and because the WorkCover was only approved for $611 a fortnight, and my rent was $680 a fortnight at the time, I still had to force myself to go to work to make extra money. You know, that meant crawling from the car to, you know, the chemist to get something, and then crawling back to the car and going to a client's house, doing a shift, you know, whilst being in the most excruciating pain you've ever thought of. But then because of the 18 months instability and damage caused during that time, after my surgery, which was in March the 11th, 2020, the week after my surgery, when we went home, was the week Australia went into lockdown. So I went into being a teacher at home with my two kids. I'm year four and year seven, and I'm going, and I'm not supposed to be moving, but you know, I had to because of the kids. And, you know, they're both at home now. I didn't have any recovery time properly, and because of that, I've now got developed retrolisthesis, which is where the vertebra, L5 vertebra, is sitting in a dislocated position, mm-hmm. which is now compressing the entire spinal column. Instead of just the nerves that come out of the vertebra, I've now got the entire spinal column being compressed, which has caused drop foot and incontinence and full loss of sexual function. So I can't feel anything in my saddle. And that's kind of the thing that I'm fighting at the moment in my internally, is having that at 43 and facing the rest of my life with this condition and just, you know, realising just how much my body is going through and has been through. And then going, oh, my God, I've still got so much longer to live like this.
You need to figure out how. But if your body could talk, what do you think it would ask you or tell you at this moment?
Stop working.
You see? So you know what to do.
I know I need to, but I'm in the process of doing a claim, damages claim, so suing the organisation. And my lawyer has told me that, you know, that one, the payout should hopefully be quite substantial, which means that I can then take time off work, because my neurologist said that if there's a physical therapy rehabilitation, mm-hmm. and he said if I could do that 3 months intensive daily physical therapy, he goes, that I have a chance of regaining some control, regaining possibly feeling, regaining, you know, all my continence even. So, but until then, my body's quite broken.
it wants you to stop working.
It wants me to stop, but until I can actually financially afford to, because now I have a mortgage, because, you know, that's what I thought it was a good idea as a single mum, take on a mortgage as well. And then quit your, you know, organisation and have your own business. And then the mortgage is completely reliant on me working. So I'm like, oh, my God. And then having to do renovations on top of it because the house had water damage.
So you like to keep yourself busy, as I understand.
Well, I don't like to, but I feel like it's
I'm non-stop, like I'm kind of, if I stop yet, then I'm afraid my body won't keep going. Mm. So I'm trying to get everything done until I can actually flop. Mm. Because even on my days off, like if on my 2 days off a fortnight that I have, the first day is usually spent in bed. Like I, my body knows that I don't have to get up, and so it just won't move. It won't allow me
least,
to move.
At least you let yourself rest on your days off. Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like I don't really have a choice, but because I'm also my work ethic and my passion towards my clients, on my what is supposed to be my days off, if another worker calls in and in the group chat and they're trying to get their shift filled, and I wait, and I'm like, come on, somebody else pick up the shift, because it's not like retail. It's not like, okay, we just close down that counter for the day, or that just won't get packed away for that. These are people's lives, especially in mental health, complex mental health. If they don't have the support, that contact, that can be enough to trigger a massive episode and put them back in hospital. So I'm like, come on, people, you know, someone put their hand up, and then no one puts their hand up. So I'm like, oh, I'll do it.
You know? So you're more focused on others than on yourself. And that's why your body say, just please give me some rest.
And I know that if I do too much focus on myself, I won't be able to move for a while. And I can't afford to not. I've got a mortgage, I've got two kids, I've got a business, I've got, you know, all these type of things. Anybody who said money can't buy happiness clearly hasn't been broke in their life, because having money and being comfortable with money will make a huge freaking difference in, you know, being able to actually...
It gives you a comfortable life, yeah.
A freedom to be able to go, hey, I'm feeling like crap at the moment. Yeah. I need to take care of myself. I'm going to go away to a retreat for 4 days, you know. I can't do that. I don't have that option. It's like even when my kid's sick, you know, I don't have... Like, I'm lucky my brother is here at the moment, and my parents have been phenomenal in helping me raise my children. But I'm one of the lucky single mums that have an amazing family and amazing friends. So my best friend who's here with me today...
Who came to support you today.
Who's my support person for the day. she's been a pivotal reason as why I'm actually in the position that I'm in now. Because when my injury happened... Like I said, I was only getting $611 a fortnight, and my rent was $680. So she financially propped me and the boys up for 3 years. And just, you know, like Christmas time, I had zero money. And so she would transfer, you know, $2,000 in my account. Mm-hmm. And that way I was able to be Santa Claus for the kids. And managed to give them a childhood still, even though I was in such a terrible way. So, like, Casey and her husband Gary have been pivotal in me being able to achieve my dream in my career and my field and what we're building for the community and, you know, that type of stuff. Without her, without a village, like my family and my close friends, I wouldn't be where I am today to be able to do what I'm doing. I wouldn't have made it through with this injury, to be honest. I wouldn't have made it through.
Amazing to have friends like that.
Oh, and that's the other thing that as a woman, because I never fitted in when I was little, when I was younger. I always was on the outside looking in. I never really had a good group of girlfriends. I was always... Like I could bounce from group to group to group to group to group and not actually really fit in with anybody. But I also didn't want to, because I found that being around a group of girls was just awful. Like there was so much bitching and competition, and that's the other thing about, with like you asked about what do I think about aging? Well,
it's now, you know, not seeing women as competition. I see them as amazing, beautiful, freaking hardcore creatures that we should be lifting each other's, you know, strengths. There's that woman walking down the street with the most longest, beautiful legs, looks like a supermodel, and instead of going, oh, it's all fake, like a lot of women turn around and do, oh, you stupid bitch or something like that, look at her and go, holy shit, you're stunning, and actually telling her, you know, just little things like that and lifting up. Like I go out of my way when I see, especially when I see a pregnant woman who just looks like she's ready to just curl up and disappear forever, and telling her how incredibly gorgeous she looks right now. You know, like that you're carrying beautifully, even if I know she looks absolutely exhausted, but actually going out of my way to tell her, you know, you look stunning. Like you just, you know, that dress looks so incredibly amazing on you, or your eyes look absolutely popping right now. Because when I was pregnant with my second, and I was crook as a dog with hyperemesis, that was horrendous. I came out of the change rooms because my big boy was only a toddler. We're at the supermarket, and this woman comes up to me, and I was wearing this strapless dress. It was a beautiful dress, but I was massive and I felt like death. And she just came up to me and she put her hand on my arm and she goes, I just need to tell you, you look absolutely glowing and beautiful right now. And the poor woman, I'm pretty sure she wasn't expecting this response, but I just turned into a blubbering snot mess, just going, oh my God, thank you so much. You know, I fell apart in the middle of the shopping centre, and, you know, I was just
That's what you needed at the time.
And that's the thing. And so that's a big part of why I am who I am and what I do, and why aging for me is actually something that I'm really embracing, is because be that person you needed when you were going through something. And that's how I live my life, and that's how I treat myself. I try to be to myself what I needed back in before I didn't know better. Yeah. Whereas mentally now and mental health wise, I know better now. So I try to treat myself the way I needed to treat myself back then, but I do it now.
But if you could go back then, at what age would you go and why? And what advice would you give yourself?
Look, I think I'd go back to being actually a teenager. Because I was raped when I was 14, which sent me on a path of destruction. And everyone goes, if you could go back and change something, would you change that? And I actually wouldn't, even though it's completely traumatic and I wish I could be who I was without that trauma, but I wouldn't be who I am today, and I wouldn't be able to support the people that I support the way I do today without having that lived experience. But I'd go back there then and actually tell to that age and to help myself through, you know, like reaching out, talking to people, tell somebody, you know, because it wasn't until 28 when it first came out, like so many other women, which is why when the Me Too movement happened, I was, you know, there was a lot of people coming on going, oh, well, if it, you know, they're only speaking up now after 20 years, then obviously it didn't happen. They're just attention seeking. And I'm like, you have no freaking clue what you're talking about. Like, the Me Too movement was phenomenal in regards to being able to give people a voice for the first time in their life, give their trauma a voice, because trauma needs to be spoken about, and you need to open that wound up so you can clean it out so that it can scab over and heal into a scar, so it's no longer infecting your life. And that's where I would go back to. I'd go back to when I was 14 and teach myself how to work through the trauma in a healthy way, as opposed to the reptilian brain kicking into gear and doing all my survival mode in all the wrong way. So I'd go back to then, and just because I still
I love who I am today, and I love the people that I have in my life. I love the community that I've created. I love the connection that I have. Yes, there are things that I'm insecure about. Once again, I'm human, hence the reason I've signed up for this.
Yeah.
You know, like...
But what do you think are the main reasons for this body image insecurities? Like, I know your story now, like, but generally...
Across the board?
Yeah, what adds up to that?
The unrealistic idea of anti-aging. Why are we so hell-bent on being young forever? Why is society and the media so pushing this unrealistic view of what happens to us in a very natural way? Like, aging's beautiful. You know, you see some of the... Like, my mum is... She's the mother of 7 children. She's also the mother of 48 foster kids. She's also the mother of a million friends and then grandchildren and, you know, all that type of stuff. And she's the most stunning woman I've ever seen in my life. And she's about the same size as me and has the most gorgeous white long hair, big waves, really thick hair, and she's just stunning. And because of her age, the era that she comes from, she's always in the mirror, you know, pulling the face up. She's always looking at the little post-menopause tubby bit that she's got, you know, all that type of stuff. And I'm like, Mum, seriously, you are the most stunning woman I've ever seen in my life. Yes, I'm biased because she's my mum, but if I showed you a photo of her, you would actually be going, holy shit, she's like model material for aging gracefully, because she has still, even though she has those insecurities, she still has just aged gracefully. Like, it's all natural. There's no nothing there. It's just, but the insecurities come from, you know, society's push for anti-aging. So fillers and Botox and dye your hair, don't go grey, you know, that type of stuff. You know, cover the wrinkles up. I think let your wrinkles free, honestly, because they tell a story, each and every one of them. I mean, my mum's story, far out. The amount of children, the amount of stuff that my mum's seen and been through and done, every wrinkle that she has, every line across her hand, I love her hands. She's got rheumatoid arthritis. And so she's got, her knuckles are really all swollen and they're starting to do the, you know, twisty type thing. Mm. But her hands tell the story to me, and I just hold them and they're beautiful. And yes, we have our head clashes like any mother-daughter does, any parent-child does. Doesn't matter how old you get. You could be 60 and your parent being 90 and you're still going to have an argument with them, because that's what parents and children do. But I don't know where I'd be without her. And so she's sort of part of the reason why, without her even knowing she's done it, she's empowered me to age gracefully and not be caught up in what society's view.
Being an example for you.
Yeah, without even realising she's done it, because she does have all those insecurities. But because she hasn't had the time to worry about any of that stuff, she's just aged naturally and just looks stunning. And I that's what I want. I just want to be, this is it, you know. I'm 43 years old. And
but how do you deal with those insecurities when they come up? What's your go-to method?
Well, my insecurities come from my injury, so the loss of sexual function, the incontinence and that type of thing. That's something that I'm fighting purely because of my, like I told you earlier, when it first came out, I was 28 when I was raped, and I did this amazing 18-week course from Heartfelt House, most amazing women, and I highly recommend everybody, in any female or male, because now they have male groups that have been through sexual trauma, to contact a centre like that. That started my healing journey and taught me how to be eventually sexually empowered. I learnt how to
orgasm. I learned how to masturbate. I learned how to not feel shame from sex, you know, all that type of stuff. And that was incredibly empowering to remove that stigma, which even without the trauma that I went through, there is still that stigma for women anyway. It's an, you know, you carry this guilt regardless of whether or not you've been through a trauma or not from enjoying sex, because women aren't supposed to do that because that makes you a slut. But it's not that way at all. Like, our bodies are essential for a reason. We have those erogenous zones for a reason. And so learning that and removing that guilt was a huge weight off my shoulders. And I empowered myself. I was in control. It was all my doing, and I was empowered by it. And then this injury happened, and it got taken all away again without my consent. And that's where my insecurities come from. It's that learning how to, even though I love being single, and I probably never want to be in a relationship ever again because I'm like super independent now, I also have that on the other hand. I go, what would be the point of dating? Because I'm useless in the bed department. Like, there's nothing there. And because there's nothing there, I don't have a libido either. So I'm, you know.
But the relationship is not only about
that. No, I know, but there's not even, like, there's not even a want. It's kind of almost to the point, and I think that's a part of the psychological block that I have from this injury, is that it makes, like, that guilt and that shame's come back again. So even if I was to be with somebody, I'm scared of how that's going to make me feel. So it's, I'm also not allowing myself to go into the dating world because of what if it brings back up all that shame and all that, you know, because I can't feel it. So what am I, a blow-up doll type thing?
What surprises me is that why we women always think that dating has, it's equal having sexual relationship, you know, like.
Exactly.
At some point of life, okay, getting old, it's not like, it's also reducing your libido anyway, like either it's injury 100%. Or not. And then, and why it always should be a sexual relationship. Like, okay, yes, it's a big part of the man-woman relationship in the young age, whatever. But let's say you're 60 and you meet someone who's 70, and so you cannot be together because you both don't want sex anymore, or like you just want to spend time together, travel together.
Yes, yeah, so companionship would be great. Yeah. I would love that.
Yeah.
I would love companionship, but it also has to be companionship where it's quiet at nighttime because, at nighttime I get very, I like my 2 hours of silence in the dark. Mm. So I'm also, you know, very protective of that space. So if I have a partner, they need to not talk for 2 hours at nighttime. So I can sit in the dark in the silence for a little while. Just until, so because my brain won't stop. I need to have that 2 hours at nighttime of dead silence, of just me, my phone in the dark, playing a game that is completely brain deading.
Two separate bedrooms.
Well, yeah, that would be great.
It's a great solution.
Because one of my friends, him and his wife built their house, and they have two separate rooms, and both of the rooms are massive because they've got their own lounge room in them as well. Mm-hmm. So they can actually have separate space. Years ago, I was like, my God, what kind of weird ass relationship is that?
Now
I look at it and I'm like, oh, that sounds phenomenal.
Yeah.
Having my own space all the time. But yeah, because if I don't do that 2 hours at nighttime of complete and utter silence, and get my brain completely dead before putting my head on the pillow, I will then, once I get my head on the pillow, if I'm not brain dead by the time I do that, my brain will click into gear and I'll go, like, stupid questions like, do penguins have knees? You know, like, this is what my brain does.
Curiosity.
This is what my brain does at nighttime. So unless I'm completely dead brain, like brain dead, I'm, you know, my brain's going to kick into gear and start asking stupid questions, which, mind you, they do have knees. I looked it up.
You see, you learned something new from your...
from my ADHD brain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I'm also, I'm trying to take care of my mental health naturally as well. So my doctor's got me on CBD oil in the morning and CBD THC at nighttime, which for the whole body experience, like pain relief, the works, it's been phenomenal. And but in regards to the hormonal side of things, because CBD and THC also has a hormonal response, so it helps stabilizes the hormones and everything. So not only is it a pain reliever, but it also is working in regard, but also other chemistry, brain chemistry as well. So it's also helping stabilize the ADHD, so I'm not so impulsive, I'm not so, you know, off the charts. I can actually recognize when I'm in a bit of a, you know, hyperfixation moment, or I'm in a bit of a manic moment, you know, that type of thing. And so I can recognize it, and I can actually put in place tools to manage those symptoms without having to take all of that hardcore medication like dexamphetamines or Duramine or, you know, all those types of Ritalin. I don't want to have to, I'm already on enough medication for, because I've developed this new condition where my layman term for it is called being allergic to living. The name for it is chronic spontaneous urticaria with angioedema phenotype, which means I'm allergic to anything, everything and nothing at all. So I have to take medication in the morning, and so I have to take 360 milligrams of fexofenadine, which is an antihistamine, which normal everyday people, if they have an allergic reaction to, or hay fever, they take one of these tablets in a day. That's all they're allowed to have. I take two in the morning, two at night time, and then two throughout the day if I start having any breakouts. And then I have a nighttime medication, so I have a morning medication on top of that antihistamine, which is an immunosuppressant one, and I have another one that's also another immunosuppressant one that I have to take at nighttime, and then once a month I have to inject my belly, two injections in my belly, just to stop me from going into anaphylaxis from waking up, you know, because that was the last time we ended up in hospital with anaphylaxis was about, about 9 months ago, and I woke up. And 45 minutes later, I was in hospital with anaphylaxis. And they had to hit me with three hits of adrenaline, which now I have to carry two EpiPens around in my bag because they said one's not going to be enough if I'm far, like, away from hospital. One EpiPen isn't going to be enough to get me to hospital.
So definitely your body is trying to tell you, like, stop, give me a break. And you keep going and going.
Well, because I don't have the option to stop yet, you know what I mean? Like, if once I get this payout through, if it's substantial enough, then I can actually take the time off and I can pay the mortgage off so that that's not hanging over me, and I can do the 3 months rehabilitation, and I can take my kids on holidays. And because at the moment they're being so amazing in understanding why I'm barely around, because my brother has been down here from Townsville and he's been taking care of them. And it's been phenomenal having him because he's been such a positive male role model for them that he's, they've settled down heaps. They're treating me differently. They're speaking differently to me because normally, because I am the only parent around, I'm their safe space. So normally I'm the one that gets everything taken out on them, you know.
My last question is, I love this question. Everyone has different answers.
Yeah.
What is your favorite quote about being a woman, or saying, or maybe your own thought? What is it?
Be who you needed back when you were a teenage girl. Mm. Be that yourself now. Be the best version of you in the space you're in. So if you're having a shit day, give yourself permission to actually just have a shit day, because just because we're female doesn't mean we're not human. So we're allowed to have feelings, we're allowed to have emotions, we're allowed to have good days, we're allowed to have bad days, we're just like any other human being on this earth. So we're not superhuman, we don't have to hold it all in, and just empower each other, lift each other up, as opposed to seeing another woman as competition, see that other woman as a sister. You know, that's, for me, that's been what has changed my outlook on life and changed how I make friends, you know. And the girlfriends that I have are soul sisters, you know, because instead of seeing them as competition and enemy, I see them as somebody who
can support each other.
I adore this woman over here. This is Casey. She is, I can't tell you, the most amazing.
She's whispering, stop.
But she's the most amazing woman I've ever met in my entire life, and everything she's been through in her life and still having the care and the love and the adoration and just being who she is. Like, she's, I hope you cry.
What a great finale for our interview. Thank you very much for sharing your story. Such a, like, a interesting life you have.
And it's one way of putting it.
Yeah. And I hope that you will enjoy the rest of your today's experience and you will get what you came for.
Yeah.
And thank you again.
Thank you.
If you have an interesting story, we'd love for you to participate. You can email us at info@alexandrawalker.com. That's Alexandra spelt with a K-S. Or visit our website, alexandrawalker.com.